This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Book Waves Art Waves programs on KPFA-FM and Pacifica Syndication. Science fiction author John Varley, who died on December 10, 2025 at the age of 78, hit the ground running with his first short story, Picnic on Nearside, which was published in 1974 in the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. He was already considered the heir to Robert Heinlein by the time his novel, The Ophiuchi Hotline, was published in 1977, and his short story collection, The Persistence of Vision, a year later. He followed those books with a trilogy that included Titan, Wizard, and Demon, then went to Hollywood for 7 years. I interviewed John Varley for Probabilities on July 17, 1992, when he returned to the field with his novel Steel Beach, which was the first of two novels set in the Eight Worlds universe of his earlier work. The sequel, The Golden Globe, was published in 1998.
Now, you burst on the scene in the late 70s with Persistence of Vision, and then followed in quick fashion by the trilogy, the Titan trilogy, and then outside of a couple of short stories like Press Enter, Beep, and Millennium, you have not been heard of, and suddenly you reemerge some 10 years later with Steel Beach. What has John Varley been doing for the last decade?
Well, I've been wasting my time in Hollywood, by and large, working on screenplays. I worked on 6 different screenplays, of which only one got made into a movie, and that is Millennium, which is not anything to be terrifically proud of. It's a living, and I've always wanted to make movies, but eventually I just reached the point where it seemed like it was driving me nuts. I was not enjoying writing anymore, and I'd had this novel which I had contracted for about 8 years previous, and which was driving my editor, Susan Allison, crazy, trying to keep Putnam from kicking my contract out into the street, along with me and my family, I suppose. So I had written the first chapter of Steel Beach, I think, 10 years ago, and I finally sat down to finish it, and things seemed to be much different. I wasn't writing as quickly, but I felt like I was writing better. And it's become a pleasure again, so much so that I'm working on another novel. As soon as I get home from this tour, I'll be starting on chapter 3, and I'm pretty happy with it.
What's the name of that novel?
The name of this is The Golden Globe. And it'll be the second of what I'm thinking of as a set of books. By no means a trilogy, and it's certainly not a sequel, because the stories do not... one book does not further the story of another. It's sort of 3 different takes on the same situation. The first one from the point of view of a journalist. The second one, The Golden Globe, will have an actor as a protagonist. And the third will be a policeman, and that will be known as Irontown Blues. This is my metal set.
What would you call the Titan books?
Oh, that's the Gaia trilogy.
And these take place in the Eight Worlds, which I guess is a very bizarre and convoluted science fiction future that you devised. What was the first story in it?
The first story was Picnic on Nearside, which introduced a lot of the ideas that I've used since in the Eight Worlds series. Other ideas came from later stories, but actually there was another first story. It was a novel that I wrote when I first decided to become a writer again, and it was a pretty bad novel. It made the rounds and was rightfully rejected, but it did have the one virtue of having described the invasion of the Earth, which is the central event of the Eight Worlds. It happens in around the year 2050. I never pinned the date down exactly, and concerns the arrival of some beings from a gas giant type planet. The name of this book was Gas Giant, by the way, which I still think is a good title, but maybe I'll have a good book to write about it, to use the title someday. And they don't view human beings as truly intelligent any more than we view ants, bees, and corals as really intelligent, although they build. From their point of view, the intelligent life on the Earth is dolphins and whales, the aquatic mammals. And they're here because they've noticed that this pesky thing called human beings have started to foul the environment to the point that it's a real hazard for the intelligent life on Earth. And they kick us off. They essentially kill about 5 or 10 billion people. I forget the exact figure. And the only humans that survive are the ones who are already established on the moon and on Mars.
So they don't actually kick anyone off. They just kill everyone.
Right. They just sort of plow all the cities underground. And with no more malice than you or I would kick over an anthill that was in the way of a plow or something.
Do you actually describe what it's like on the Earth at that point?
Well, there's a sequence in the Afuyuki Hotline where the main character goes back to the Earth, which is in a pristine Garden of Eden sort of condition. Frankly, it's been so long since I read the book, I don't remember much about that scene. I don't go back and read most of my own things, which proved to be a bit of a problem, by the way, on Steel Beach. I think I should mention this, that the long tradition of future histories, which I suppose this is that you make them all mesh together and you have the events. You write a timeline like Robert Heinlein did back in the 40s for John W. Campbell. Well, I found that I just couldn't do that. I did not want to go back and read all these books that I had not read in 15 years, because I found that when that sort of gap goes by, I find most of the prose pretty intolerable. So I just started to wing it and played it by ear. I brought in some characters from the old books and in some of the technology, and essentially decided that this is a new take on the Eight Worlds. It's maybe sort of an alternate Eight Worlds. And I included a note to that effect in the back so that people won't get too upset and write me and tell me about how this doesn't work with the Phantom of Kansas or some other story that I've written.
This takes place long before the events of Ofuyuki Hotline, though.
Yes, much earlier.
Because the experiments concerning cloning and memory imprinting are only beginning to get underway in Steel Beach.
I found that to be a lot more interesting to me. And the Afuyuki Hotline was heading out toward some sort of blue sky region, which I had really no idea of what to do after that. But there was all sorts of stories to be told in the earlier days about how these things came to be. I had the same sort of thing with another story I wrote years ago called Options. Terry Carr bought it, and in his introduction to the story, when it was printed in his one of his anthologies, he said that one thing he had always wondered about the Eight Worlds is how do we get from here to there, and this was an attempt to show part of the civilization in transition between the sexual mores that we know today and many other things, and the society that I described much later on in the novels further down the stream.
Were any of the screenplays you wrote related to Eight Worlds at all?
No, none of them. Two of them were really bad ideas from the beginning, I think. I never should have gotten involved in them, and only did because they waved a lot of money in my face. I can be tempted that way, but I hope not any longer. Three of the others were good science fiction ideas. One in particular, I think, would still make a good movie if I could get the rights back and get somebody interested. It was a adaptation of Have Space Suit Will Travel by Robert Heinlein. I've always thought that any of those juvenile novels of Heinlein would make a good movie, and that was my particular favorite. They all have story problems of one kind or another when you change them to a screenplay. None of them are really insoluble.
Well, I want to get a little bit more to Hollywood a little later, but Steel Beach, this is your first very long novel.
Yes, right. I think
yeah.
So.
There are a number of extraordinary ideas that pop up in Steel Beach. I remember when you first burst on the scene, the astonishing thing was the number of ideas that were crammed into those short stories and then eventually into Ofuyuki Hotline. And then you took a completely different set of ideas and put them into the Gaia trilogy. But some of the ideas that I have here, I'd like you to comment on as we get to them. One is the sex changes. People can change their sexes back and forth, boy into girl, and they seem fairly at ease with it. Whereas I think most of us define our identity somehow by what sex we are.
Yeah, that's a big difference. And like I mentioned before, the story Options showed a more transitional society where more people were upset. But this is another example of a different take that I have in Steel Beach than I had from the earlier stories. When I first came up with this idea, I thought about it and I thought about it, and I decided that most people, if they had grown up in a sex-changing world where you're not identified with one gender for your entire life, or at least you need not be, that they would be comfortable with it, and there would be sort of a pansexuality, that the idea of homosexuality, for instance, would be fairly foreign, because why should you restrict yourself to just one sex when you can be either sex? But after much more experience and much more reading and having a lot longer to think about it, I decided that human sexuality was a lot more complicated than that. And in Steel Beach, it's implied that the number of permutations of sexual orientation are just about infinite. There are people who, for instance, would only make love with a man, whether they happen to be male or female at the time. There are people who would only make love with the opposite sex. And you can begin adding up the possibilities of all these different things. And there are people, of course, who never change, people who change every week because it's the fashionable thing to do. I think that there are even more options in Steel Beach than there were in the others.
You mentioned some of that. A great deal of the book is devoted to discourses on these various principles and ideas, and I guess that's part of deepening the concepts in this book, is that you do that. It's almost Heinlein-esque the way you do it.
I hope you mean that in the good sense.
In the good sense.
Yeah, I don't consciously set out to do things in a Heinlein-esque way. He is such an influence on me that these things always happen. He was my favorite author for all of my reading childhood and stayed my favorite author for a very long time.
Now, the character, Hildy Johnson, whose real name is Mario something or other, or Maria something or other, spends the first half of the book as a man and the second half as a woman. Was that idea there from the start?
Yes, it was. It's more like one-third and two-thirds, I think. And it was consciously decided, I decided consciously to do it that way. It was a challenge I set myself. I think it's going to be tough for some readers to begin with a character who is a man, and then right in midstream, you have to start thinking of this man as something else. And I've had some comments back. I haven't had any negative comments on it, but people have said that, yeah, this is you just have to stop and think here for a minute, and it makes you examine a lot of your own assumptions, I think. I didn't do it for that purpose. I didn't do it as any kind of a trick, but I just thought it would be a good way to illustrate how this can be done, how in this society. He just at some point decides that he's uncomfortable as he is and changes, and knows that that according to his own patterns that he'll probably change back in somewhere between 10 and 30 years. He's not somebody who casually changes sex, but through his life he has. And later, of course, she. And this begins to make the book kind of difficult to discuss sometimes because you say the main character, Hildy Johnson, and are not quite sure which pronoun to use.
Well, I noticed that some people change their names and some don't, depending upon what it is. It's everything seems wide open. How can one maintain identity? Wouldn't one completely lose your identity at a certain point? Because you could also change your physical appearance.
I think that would be a hazard. I have not really gotten into it too much, but it's going to be in the upcoming stories. How do you identify friends, for instance, if they this is the external way of looking at it. Your best friend could come back as a different sex the next day, a total stranger. I have some ideas on it, but I really couldn't get into them in this amount of time. Plus, I'm saving them for the book.
Well, some of the other ideas that you tap into, one is the Disneyland's ideas. Now, that comes from, what was it, Phantom of Kansas? Was that the first Disneyland book?
As far as I remember, that was the first one. Yeah, that involved someone who was a weather engineer inside one of these Disneylands, which are big bubbles excavated beneath the surface of the moon that vary from about 10 miles up to about 50 miles across, and environments are created in there. And the character in Phantom of Kansas became an artist sculpting the weather.
And the one here lives in the Texas one.
Right, West Texas, which covers about a 500-mile area and about a 40-mile diameter bubble. This is a historical Disneyland. You could think of it like Colonial Williamsburg, where people are dressed as the proper time and using the tools of the time. But it goes even further. You can't bring anything in legally into these Disneys that is not appropriate technology, which in this case is about from about 1830 to about 1890. So you can have railroads, but you can't have airplanes.
Well, now, would there have been any Disneys prior to the invasion, or is this all post-invasion?
I postulate that it would be post-invasion, that they're like cultural records, record-keeping. I mentioned also at some point in the book that most languages that are being used today are virtually dead, that only some of the major languages survived because, of course, they just weren't in very common use. But the government pays some people to keep these languages alive. Hildy's mother, for instance, is fluent in Italian, which is not a language that would have been widespread. But she and other Italian speakers get together just to keep it alive so that human knowledge is not lost.
You also have interesting generation gaps because longevity has become, virtual immortality has become the way people live. So they only die by accident or suicide.
Mm-hmm. I think that could be a gigantic problem, and that's another one I'm going to be going into more deeply. But you have people who are pushing 300 years old side by side with people who are 20 and young adults. And you know they're going to have a very different outlook on the universe and what life is all about. There's a very practical matter I mentioned, too, that the younger generation is getting taller and taller, so they don't even tend to go into the places where their elders are because they're always hitting their heads.
Well, how tall is Brenda, who is 17, I believe, when the novel opens up?
She's about 7.5 feet.
And Hildy is?
About 6.
And they're just going more and more like that.
Yeah. And I don't have any scientific reason to back this up, but it just seems interesting that generations growing up in lower gravity would get taller and skinnier. I think Larry Niven used the same idea.
You also have a central computer that reminded me vaguely of The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, mm-hmm. which is a Heinlein book. Was that deliberate?
No, but if you're going to write about a large artificial intelligence that doesn't speak in a ponderous manner, you're going to sound like Mike the computer from The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. There's just really not much way to avoid it.
The computer creates these virtual realities that people find themselves in. Now, that's an entirely new world, yet another thing. That didn't appear in any of the other ones previous, did it?
No, I don't believe so. I don't think virtual reality was much of a concept at the time I was writing those. I would have had to have been way ahead of my time to be thinking about that, and unfortunately I wasn't. But that's another thing that'll be in some of the later books. They call it direct interfacing, and you don't need to put on a helmet to do it. You just sort of flip a metal switch, and you're interfacing with the computer and whatever sort of environment he puts you into. Hildy has been resisting this, more or less. Well, frankly, because Hildy, of course, is always going to be a little bit like me, and I've been resisting the computer revolution for about 20 years now. I'm one of the few writers that still uses a typewriter. And plus, it made the story more interesting, and it made it easier to explain a few things to the reader if Hildy was not up to the minute in the current computer technology.
You also have these things called mini-bots, which travel through the body.
Nanobots, actually.
Nanobots, right. I mean, excuse me.
Mini is just small. Nano is incredibly small.
You have one that these little microorganisms or nanoorganisms that actually can clean teeth and keep teeth clean.
Well, they're actually more of machines. The idea of a nanobot is not mine at all. It's been an idea that's been explored a lot in science fiction lately. But it's a technology which is definitely developing. You can build machines using some of the same principles that are used to make the very, very tiny transistors that go into computers. And where it may end, who really knows? Some of the ones that can be built right now are too small to see with the naked eye, but they have things in them like gears and electrical motors. I don't see why you couldn't build them even smaller using molecular components. They're sort of, at that level, I guess they would be a combination between chemical action and mechanical action. But the things that these things could do, if they could be built, is just virtually limitless.
You also have reconstituted brontosauruses. Are you familiar with Jurassic Park by Michael Crichton?
I'm familiar. I haven't read it. I'm aware of it, but I really ought to read that. I've always liked dinosaurs, and I've liked Michael Crichton, so I really ought to read the book.
But there was no link up. You had thought of that idea separately.
No, it was separate.
Well, he gives a scientific explanation for why a brontosaur could be reinvented. which is simply being able to somehow go back to the fossils and reconstitute based upon what's in the fossils.
I thought about that, but I didn't really know how to do it. I talked to some people, asked if there would be such a thing as fossilized DNA, and they seemed to think no. But given the gene splicing techniques that would be available to this civilization, you could draw a picture of a creature that you'd like to make and then get to work on the genes and until you have it right. And as to why, I was tickled by the idea of dinosaurs on the moon, I think.
Well, what Crichton suggests is that you actually can do it by manipulating, say, a frog's DNA.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And what you wind up with, rather than being what our image of what a dinosaur looks like, is actually what the dinosaur was. And he postulates them being very different than what we would expect them to be,
mm-hmm.
that they move more like birds, for example.
Yeah, that's a current theory I've been reading about that they were not as – most of them are probably not as ponderous or as cold-blooded as we might have thought.
You also have force field spacesuits and spacesuits for dogs, which you put a dog named Winston inside of.
Well, the force field spacesuits are not new with me. I had used them in many earlier stories. This is sort of like the origin of them, where they came from, although it's contradictory to what I've said in an earlier book. Someone pointed out to me that I said that these spacesuits came from the Ophiuchi hotline, which is a interstellar signal from another star, which gives us technology. But I pointed out to him that in this book, Steel Beach, these spacesuits are invented by a kind of a mad genius there on the moon, or at least he says so. I mean, how do you know that he is actually telling the truth? Or how do you know that the people who thought that they came from the Ophiuchi hotline in the first book were not misinformed? That's where I feel like I have a little bit of slack in the idea of a future history, is that history is always someone's version of what went down and never exactly what did go down.
Well, the Ophiuchi hotline simply doesn't exist in Steel Beach.
Right, right. It hasn't been mentioned or discovered.
And that was deliberate.
Yes.
Does the Ophiuchi hotline actually exist at that era?
I'm pretty sure it does. In fact, in the next book, in the next book, it may be mentioned again. About the dogs in spacesuits, though. That was an idea that just came to me. I thought humans going into space, of course, if we ever actually begin to live there, we're going to take our pets. I was really enchanted by the idea of a bulldog in a spacesuit. And this next book, I've got a different kind of a spacesuit for a smaller dog that's more like one of these balls that you put a gerbil inside and it goes running around the floor. And that's going to be fun, too.
You also have religions on the moon, because the religions that we know of would no longer exist in this future society.
Well, they do exist, but they're not as dominant as they are here on the Earth.
So you have a religion, the Flax,
mm-hmm.
who are what?
Oh, this is the first latitudinarian church of celebrity saints. They essentially believe that whatever fame and fortune you're going to get, you should get right here in this life. And they've enshrined, I think it's four celebrities. The first is Elvis, because it was 100 years after his death, there were still people who were citing him in a flying saucer. Personally, I hope that he's forgotten by then, at least on that level, but I hope his music lives. But this insanity of every time you turn a corner, there's Elvis. But on the other hand, it might live. Who knows? This real cult of celebrity didn't really get started until the 20th century with mass media and mass communications. And these people just worship the most famous people that have ever lived. The more famous you are, the more worthy you are of worship.
What kinds of religions do you think would come up? I mean, is there anything other, any other kinds of religions?
I'm inventing another one that's fairly standard for Pluto in the second book. There's nothing really revolutionary about this, postulating that Pluto could be used as a transportation, a colony for transportees like Australia. This is an old idea in science fiction. I'll admit it right here on the air. But as part of their rebellion against the straight society, they become sort of devil worshippers, not human sacrifice kind of people, but this is another major religion that's been established since the invasion.
Back in the early 80s, you composed a trilogy, the Gaia trilogy, Titan, Wizard, and
Demon,
which It's probably one of the most famous feminist trilogies. And what was interesting about that, as well as some of your other work, is that it had that Heinlein-esque flavor, yet your politics were totally opposite from Heinlein's. Has that changed at all?
Well, I don't know if they were totally opposite, and I have gone through a lot of changes. A lot of ideas that I thought would work out seem to me have been disproven by time. I'm all over the place politically these days. I have some very liberal ideas and some very conservative ideas, but mostly I just have a lot of questions. I like to propose things. This is something I've shared with Heinlein. He would propose any kind of a wild idea, and sometimes he got in trouble because people thought he was really serious about it. And of course, sometimes he was really serious about it, but you were never absolutely sure. I just like to propose possible solutions to problems and then write about them and see what people think.
What areas do you think you're most liberal or most conservative in?
That gets to be a slippery question of definitions, because I believe in leaving each other alone unless it's absolutely necessary. And I don't know if you'd call that liberal or conservative. To me, I would think that a conservative would endorse that principle, and yet they're the ones that want to oppose a woman's right to choose an abortion, for instance. So people tend to contradict themselves. I've given up on the liberal idea that seemed to be going around when I was younger, that if the government spends a lot of money on a problem, it's going to make the problem better. I've certainly become conservative in that area. I don't want the government to ignore all the problems, but on the other hand, there have been so many failures since those high hopes of the Kennedy and Johnson years.
So do you think your book reflects then, those changes?
I think it does in some ways, as a subtext, not really out there in the open all the time.
Do you think that your feelings about human nature itself have changed?
Yes, in a lot of ways. You mentioned feminism. I've had some second thoughts on some things and have wondered if I might get any flack from feminists in this book, not because I've done anything that's anti-woman or anything like that, but I feel like I've gone back on some of the more outrageous ideas I might have had involving sex changing and so forth in the earlier books.
Like what?
Well, the idea of everybody living together in one big happy family, I guess, with no... I guess I sort of figured that if everybody could change sex, for instance, there would be no more child molesters. I don't believe that anymore. I believe the humans are basically perverse enough that they'll find a way to commit some horrible sin no matter how good things are. Maybe my opinion of humanity has just sort of gone down a little bit. I mean, I'm basically an optimist, but I've got to be aware of all the problems around us.
Do you think that the Gaia trilogy would have been any different?
No, not really. I've always viewed that as basically an adventure story, and I enjoyed writing it, but I don't think I had a whole lot to really say to society in those books. I explored some ideas about, this is a theme that keeps coming back to me unconsciously, of godlike intelligence and how it relates to human beings. But that's sort of a peevish thing on my part almost, is that I've always wanted to grab a hold of God and, you know, scream at him and ask him why he did certain things.
Well, it struck me in that book that one of the extraordinary things was the strength and depth of the women characters in particular.
I don't really see what's so extraordinary about that. I've just always seen women as very strong. I guess the reason it's unusual is because if you watch a movie, the woman is always there to be rescued by the man, which bores the hell out of me. I'm not interested in writing about a woman who is so helpless, unless there's a very good story reason for it to be. Otherwise, I want to write about strong men and women.
Hollywood.
Oh, back to Hollywood again.
What lured you away? You know, John Varley was the last great hope of the science fiction community in the late 70s.
Oh, really?
There was a big turnover of writers, and a whole young generation came along. There was Varley and Joan Vinge and a few others there, and you were leading the pack. And one by one, they've kind of dropped by the wayside, but Varley disappeared entirely. Were you aware that you had that reputation?
No, I don't think so. I just hadn't really thought about it much at all. I knew that I'd write books again, but and when I met people who were science fiction readers, they'd say, "Well, when is your next book coming out?" But they didn't really say, "You vanished." They would tell me that they liked the stories. It just never really occurred to me that I had completely disappeared.
Well, I mean, there was an occasional. There was press,
yeah,
beep and enter, yeah.
Yeah, there were some stories here and there. It's just Hollywood is so seductive. for two basic reasons. I am a movie lover. I've always loved movies, and I would like to make a really good movie. And the second reason, as always in Hollywood, is that the money is real good.
What's the genesis of Millennium? I mean, it started with Air Raid, the story Air Raid.
Yeah. Well, that's where it came from. You mean the genesis of the film, or how did it get
there? Yeah, I mean, and your role in it, yeah.
It became a movie essentially because Dennis Lasker, an assistant to John Foreman, a producer, read the short story on an airplane one day, and it really scared him. And he took it to John Foreman, who said this could make a good movie. And next thing I knew, I was in a meeting with some pretty high-powered people. And that was approximately, I think, 10 years before it got made.
What happened in the interim?
Everything that could possibly happen to a movie happened to Millennium. We went through six directors before we ever shot a frame of film. The final version has got seven names as producer from all various levels of production. What they all did, I haven't the vaguest idea because as far as I was concerned, only one of them did any real work. Oh, financing falling through. John Foreman is really the reason it got made, as he always believed in it, and every time it went dead on the water, he would find another way to revive it. At one point, here's an example of the kind of things that happened to this film. At one point, it was going to be made in Russia, in the Soviet Union at the time. I can't remember the name of the city, but he was going to have the cooperation of the Soviet Army and one of the world's largest airplane hangars, big enough to put 4 747s inside, and we were going to recreate the crash of a huge airplane and all. And the next day, Chernobyl blew up and started scattering radioactivity on this town where we were going to be filming it. Things fully as melodramatic as that have killed it at least three times.
How much of the screenplay that finally got made was yours?
Well, in the sense that I was at the typewriter, it's all mine. But that was what was filmed is... I've been calling it the eighth draft. That's pretty close. And it contains ideas from all of the six directors, good or bad. Frankly, I lost track of what I was doing at some point. Somewhere in those 10 years, the spark went out of me. And I just stuck with it almost out of reflex because I knew they'd hire another writer if I didn't do another one more rewrite.
Well, nothing personal. It's a terrible movie.
Oh, it is. Yes, I know.
What happened when you first saw it?
And I have the sole writing credit, too. I'm so proud.
What happened to you when you first saw it?
By then I knew what to expect, I think. I had a great deal of fun being in Toronto for 6 months watching the making of the movie, and I learned a great deal from that, which is going to be used in some book at some point in the future. I learned a lot of valuable lessons. I learned when to hold out and when to compromise a little bit. I think at least I'll do a better job the next time, if there is a next time. Or at the current moment, I don't plan any next time.
So now you're back writing novels.
Definitely.
Short stories as well?
If I get a short story idea, I will do one. I did one just a few months back, which I sold to Playboy, and it'll be out in the November issue.
So now we have Steel Beach. We have these two, not sequels, but...
Two of the set, yeah.
Two of the set. What else is going on? Do you have any other ideas that you plan on surfacing? Any non-science fiction?
I've been planning a mystery novel for a good long time now. I read a lot of mysteries and enjoy them. That's really about all I can say is that I have a character, I have a setting... And I have most of a plot. If I could just get the time to write it, I would like to try my hand at that and see how it works. I'm also planning, this is a little bit more blue sky and depends a whole lot on our schedules, but I would like to do a collaboration with Spider Robinson. We've been talking about it off and on for years and came to sort of a breakthrough a few months ago, but I can't talk about that too much either because it's all very much up in the air.
And no more movies for a while.
And I certainly don't intend to.
Is the Gaia trilogy available these days?
It's one of those three books, and Millennium are the ones that you can usually find in the bookstore. I'm more concerned about the story collections, none of which are very easy to find these days. The Persistence of Vision, I think, is the best book that I've written thus far. It has most of my best stories in it. I would like to have that more easily available.
John Varley would never return to Hollywood. His film Millennium is not currently streaming. IMDb lists a PBS version of his short story, Overdrawn at the Memory Bank, which can be watched on Pluto TV, and there are two episodes of a Canadian science fiction anthology series, Welcome to Paradox, which are available on YouTube and are adaptations of two other short stories. Following his novel, The Golden Globe, John Varley wrote seven novels, most of which were in a new series titled Thunder and Lightning. He returned to the Eight Worlds for his final novel, Irontown Blues, published in 2018. While much of his work is currently out of print, used copies are easy to find. You've been listening to an interview with the late science fiction author John Varley, who died on December 10, 2025, at the age of 78. The interview was recorded July 17, 1992, while he was on tour for his novel, Steel Beach. Until next time, I'm Rich Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays. You can write to me either at bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky Radio Shows on Facebook.